From the crest of the pass, we looked back at the cool blue of the sea for the last time and then dropped down into that sweltering wilderness of rock and sand that stood between us and the Nile. As we moved forward, the heat came at us like a mortal enemy. It seemed to enter through our mouths and nostrils as we gasped for breath. It sucked the moisture from our bodies like a thief. It dried out our skin and cracked it until our lips burst open like overripe figs. The rocks beneath our feet were hot, as though fresh from the potmaker's kiln, and they scalded and blistered our feet even through the leather soles of our sandals. It was impossible to continue the march during the hottest hours of the day. We lay in the flimsy shade of the linen tents that Tiamat had provided, and panted like hunting dogs after the chase. When the sun sank towards the jagged rock horizon, we went on. The desert around us was charged with such a brooding, nameless menace that even the high spirits of the blue crocodile guards were subdued. The long, slow column wound like a maimed adder through the black rock outcrops and tawny, lion-coloured dunes, following the ancient road along which countless other travellers had passed before us. When night fell at last, the sky came alive with such a dazzle of stars, and the desert was lit so brightly that from my place at the head of the caravan I could recognise the shape of Kratas at the tail, although 200 paces separated us. We marched on for half the night before Tanos gave the order to fall out. Then he had us up before dawn, and we marched on until the heat mirage dissolved the rocky outcrops around us and made the horizon swim so that it seemed to be moulded from melting pitch. We saw no other sign of life, except that once a troop of dog-headed baboons barked at us from the cliffs of a stark rock tableland as we passed below them, and the vultures soared so high in the hot blue sky that they appeared to be but dust motes swirling in slow and deliberate circles high above us. When we rested in the middle of the day, the whirlwinds pirouetted and swayed with the peculiar grace of dancing houris across the plain, and the cupful of water that was our ration seemed to turn to steam in my mouth. "Where are they?" Kratas growled angrily. "By Seth's sweaty scrotum, I hope these little birds will soon puff up their courage and come in to roost." Although they were all tough veterans and inured to hardship and discomfort, nerves and tempers were wearing thin. Good comrades and old friends began to snarl at each other for no reason and bicker over the water ration. "Shufti is a cunning old dog," I told Tanos. "He will gather his forces and wait for us to come to him, rather than hurry to meet us. He will let us tire ourselves with the journey and grow careless with our fatigue before he strikes." On the fifth day I knew that we were approaching the oasis of Galala, when I saw that the dark cliffs ahead of us were riddled with the caves of ancient tombs. Centuries ago, the oasis had supported a thriving city, but then an earthquake had shaken the hills and damaged the wells. The water had dwindled to a few seeping drops. Even though the wells had been dug deeper to reach the receding water, and the earthen steps reached down to where the surface of the water was always in shade, the city had died. The roofless walls stood forlorn in the silence, and lizards sunned themselves in the courtyards where rich merchants had once dallied with their harems. Our very first concern was to refill the water skins. The voices of the men drawing water at the bottom of the well were distorted by the echoes in the deep shaft. While they were busy, Tanos and I made a swift tour of the ruined city. It was a lonely and melancholy place. In its centre was the dilapidated temple to the patron god of Galala. The roof had fallen in and the walls were collapsing in places. It had but a single entrance through the crumbling gateway at the western end. "This will do admirably," Tanos muttered, as he strode across it, measuring it with his soldier's eye for fortification and ambuscade. When I questioned him on his intentions, he smiled and shook his head. "Leave that part of it to me, old friend. The fighting is my business." As we stood at the centre of the temple, I noticed the tracks of a troop of baboons in the dust at our feet, and I pointed them out to Tanos. "They must come to drink at the wells," I told him. That evening, when we sat around the small smoky fires of dried donkey dung in the ancient temple, we heard the baboons again, the old bull apes barking a challenge in the hills that surrounded the ruined city. Their voices boomed back and forth along the cliffs, and I nodded at Tanos across the fire. "Your friend Shufti has arrived at last. His scouts are in the hills up there watching us now. It is they who have alarmed the baboons." I hope you are right. My blackguards are close to mutiny. They know this is all your idea, and if you are wrong, I might have to give them your head or your backside to appease them, Tunnus growled, and went to speak to Astes at the neighbouring cooking fire. Swiftly, a new mood infected the camp, as they realised that the enemy was near. The scowls evaporated and the men grinned at each other in the firelight as they surreptitiously tested the edges of their swords concealed beneath the sleeping mats on which they sat. However, they were canny veterans, and they went through the motions of normal caravan life so as not to alert the watchers in the dark hills above us. At last we were all bundled onto our mats, and the fires died down, but none of us slept. I could hear them coughing and fidgeting restlessly all around me in the dark. The long hours drew out, and through the open roof I watched the great constellations of the stars wheel in stately splendour overhead. But still the attack never came. Just before dawn, Tunnus made his round of the sentries for the last time, and then, on his way back to his place beside the cooling ashes of last night's fire, he stopped by my mat for a moment and whispered, "You and your friends, the baboons, you deserve each other. All of you bark at shadows." "The shrikes are here. I can smell them. The hills are full of them," I protested. "All you can smell is the promise of breakfast," he grunted. He knows how I detest the suggestion that I am a glutton. Rather than reply to such callow humour, I went out into the darkness to relieve myself behind the nearest pile of ruins. As I squatted there, a baboon barked again, the wild, booming cry shattering the preternatural silences of that last and darkest of the night watches. I turned my head in that direction and heard, faint and far away, the sound of metal strike rock, as though a nervous hand had dropped a dagger up there on the ridge, or a careless shield had brushed against a granite outcrop as an armed man hurried to take up his station before the dawn found him out. I smiled complacently to myself. There are few pleasures in my life compared to that of making Tunnus eat his words. As I returned to my mat, I whispered to the men that I passed, "Be ready, they are here." And I heard my warning passed on from mouth to sleepless mouth. Above me the stars began to fade away, and the dawn crept up on us as stealthily as a lioness stalking a herd of oryx. Then abruptly I heard a sentry on the west wall of the temple whistle, a liquid warble that might have been the cry of a nightjar, except that we all knew better. And instantly a stir ran through the camp. It was checked by the low but urgent whispers of Kratos and his officers, "Steady the blues, remember your orders, hold your positions," and not a man stirred from his sleeping mat. Without rising, and with my shawl masking my face, I turned my head slowly and looked up at the crests of the cliffs that stood higher than the temple walls. The shark's tooth silhouette of the granite hills began to alter most subtly. I had to blink my eyes to be certain of what I was seeing. Then slowly I turned my head in a full circle, and it was the same in whichever direction I looked. The skyline all about us was picketed with the dark and menacing shapes of armed men. They formed an unbroken palisade around us, through which no fugitive could hope to escape. I knew then why Shufti had delayed his retaliation so long. It would have taken him all this time to gather together such an army of thieves. There must be 1,000 or more of them, although in the poor light it was not possible to count their multitudes. We were outnumbered at least 10 to 1, and I felt my spirits quail. It was poor odds, even for a company of the blues. The shrikes stood as still as the rocks around them, and I was alarmed at this evidence of their discipline. I had expected them to come streaming down upon us in an untidy rabble, but they were behaving like trained warriors. Their stillness was more menacing and intimidating than any wild shouting and brandishing of weapons would have been. As the light strengthened swiftly, we could make them out more clearly. The first rays of the sun glanced off the bronze of their shields and their bared sword blades, and struck darts of light into our eyes. Every one of them was muffled up, a scarf of black wool wound around each head, so that only their eyes showed in the slits, eyes as malevolent as those of the ferocious blue sharks that terrorized the waters of the sea we had left behind us. The silence drew out, until I thought that my nerves might tear, and my heart burst with the pressure of blood within it. Then suddenly a voice rang out, shattering the dawn silence and echoing along the cliffs. "Karik! Are you awake?" I recognized Shufti then, despite the scarf that masked him. He stood in the center of the west wall of the cliff, where the road cut through it. "Karik!" he called again. "It is time for you to pay what you owe me. But the price has risen. I want everything now." "Everything," he repeated, and flung aside the scarf so that his pockmarked features were revealed. "I want everything you have, including your stupid and arrogant head." Tanus rose from his mat and threw aside his sheepskin rug. "Then you will have to come down and take it from me," he shouted back, and drew his sword. Shufti raised his right arm, and his blind eye caught the light and gleamed like a silver coin. Then he brought his arm down abruptly. At his signal, a shout went up from the ranks of men that lined the high ground, and they lifted their weapons and shook them to the pale yellow dawn sky. Shufti waved them forward, and they streamed down the cliffs in a torrent into the narrow valley of Galala. Tanus raced to the center of the temple court where the ancient inhabitants had raised a tall stone altar to their patron Bes, the dwarf god of music and drunkenness. Kratos and his officers ran to join him, while the slave girls and I crouched on our mats and covered our heads, wailing with terror. Tanus leapt up onto the altar and went down on one knee as he flexed the great bow Lanata. It took all of his strength to string it, but when he stood erect again, it shimmered in its coils of silver electrum wire as though it were a living thing. He reached over his shoulder and drew an arrow from the quiver on his back and faced the main gateway through which the horde of shrikes must enter. Below the altar, Kratos had drawn up his men into a single rank, and they also had strung their bows and faced the entrance to the square. They made a pitiful small cluster around the altar, and I felt a lump rise in my throat as I watched them. They were so heroic and undaunted. I would compose a sonnet in their honour, I decided on a sudden impulse, but before I could find the first line, the head of the mob of bandits burst howling through the ruined gateway. Only 5 men abreast could climb the steep stairway into the opening, and the distance to where Tanus stood on the altar was less than 40 paces. Tanus drew and let his first arrow fly. That single arrow killed 3 men. The first of them was a tall rogue dressed in a short kilt, with long greasy tresses of hair streaming down his back. The arrow took him in the centre of his naked chest and passed through his torso as cleanly as though he were merely a target cut from a sheet of papyrus. Slick with the blood of the first man, the arrow struck the man behind him in the throat. Although the force of it was dissipating now, it still went through his neck and came out behind him. But it could not drive completely through. The fletchings at the back of the shaft snagged in his flesh, while the barbed bronze arrowhead buried itself in the eye of the third man who had crowded up close behind him. The 2 shrikes were pinned together by the arrow, and they staggered and thrashed about in the middle of the gateway, blocking the opening to those who were trying to push their way past them into the courtyard. At last the arrowhead tore out of the third man's skull, with the eye impaled upon the point. The 2 stricken men fell apart, and a throng of screaming bandits poured over them into the square. The small band around the altar met them with a volley of arrows, shooting them down so that their corpses almost blocked the opening, and those coming in from behind were forced to scramble over the mounds of dead and wounded. It could not last much longer. The pressure of warriors from behind was too great, and their numbers too overwhelming, like the bursting of an earthen dike unable to stem the rising flood of the Nile. They forced the opening, and a solid mass of fighting men poured into the square and surrounded the tiny band around the altar of the god Bes.